I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, what if today NASA suddenly announced that they found evidence of life on Mars? Not just life, but an advanced civilization that was inhabiting our planetary neighbor. How would you react? How would that permeate our culture and our sense of our place in the universe? In the 1890s, a popular science expert was convinced that Mars was populated. He presented proof, and even respected newspapers of that era ran with it. And Mars mania grabbed America. Of course, they were wrong. We now know Mars is more or less a barren world. But what did we learn about ourselves in the hunt for real Martians? What long-lasting cultural impact did Mars mania leave on us? And maybe that's why humanity has an itch to go to Mars. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source. But first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Later today, about 300 miles southeast of San Antonio on Boca Chica Beach, SpaceX will try again to launch its Starship. If successful, that launch would be another step forward towards building a sustainable city on Mars. That's according to Elon Musk, the man who owns SpaceX and other high-tech companies. Musk is convinced that his goal of making humanity a multi-planetary species is achievable, and Mars is the planet that he has set his sights on. But why Mars? How did that red planet get into our cultural DNA as a possible home? Well, there was a time when many people thought Mars was already inhabited with an advanced, peaceful civilization. That was around the 1890s, and Mars mania gripped the nation. Former NPR science reporter David Barron has written a book about that time and that phenomenon called The Martians, The True Story of an Alien Craze That Captured the Turn of the Century America. And David, welcome back to The Source.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So this is an interesting look at that time and that era. Very different than today, but not so different when you think about it. This was a time when there are a lot of scientific discoveries and things were changing quite a bit. And the idea of what was possible really seemed to be very fluid at the time. And someone said, hey, look, I've got proof that there are Martians on Mars, canals, a society, and people, they were willing to buy into that. What happened?
Well, I do think there are a lot of parallels to today. And that's one of the reasons I decided to write the book. I love writing history. I'm a science writer. I'm particularly interested in science history. But if I'm going to spend years writing a book, it's got to be a history that says something about today. So this was a period, the end of basically the latter days of the Gilded Age, when there was a great divide between the rich and the poor, much like there is today. Technology was both exciting and unsettling. Today, we worry that AI could be, the downfall of society, or maybe it'll be our savior. Back then, it was a lot of excitement about changes in transportation, automobiles and airplanes, the discovery of X-rays and radio waves. There was so much changing so rapidly, people were unsettled. And back then, and I think today, people were and are looking elsewhere for signs of salvation. And I know it sounds a little extreme to say that, but the belief in the Martians that I write about in my book really said more about what was happening here on Earth than what people were seeing on Mars. People really wanted to believe that it was possible that there was a better world out there that we could go to or emulate.
Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, and you can email us at thesource@tpr.org. Are you fascinated by Mars, the thought of going there, living there, there's something on Mars? David, in July of 1976, NASA's Viking 1 orbiter, taking photographs of the surface of Mars, came across a something that looked like a giant human face about a mile long. They took a picture of it, and people were just freaking out. Like, there it is, folks, evidence of something on the surface of Mars. So we could say, you know, we're more sophisticated than the folks back then, around the turn of the century, but maybe not so much. It doesn't take a whole lot for people to kind of fall back into that gravity well of thinking there's something out there.
Right. Well, that face on Mars, I'm sure many of your listeners saw pictures of it. It really was quite something. It looked sort of like some ancient monument by some extinct civilization that was left on Mars. But another picture was taken of the exact same feature, I believe 25 years later. And, you know, it was not a face. It looked like a face when it was lit from by the sun from a certain angle, but it was just a very natural butte or some kind of landform. That, again, when lit a certain way, had two eyes and a mouth. But it shows, you know, we want to believe, perhaps, that there's something out there. So getting back to the story in my book, you know, for centuries leading up to the late 19th century, science had been undermining traditional beliefs in religion, from Copernicus to Galileo to Newton to certainly Darwin. Science seemed to be leaving very little room for a God who was active in human affairs. Maybe there was a God who created the universe, but natural laws seem to explain the functioning of how that planets orbit and how species evolve. And what happened at the end of the 19th century was a scientist came along. His name was Percival Lowell. He was an astronomer who came up with a theory to explain strange things that were being seen on Mars that suggested that there was an advanced civilization on Mars that was more advanced than we are, that was beyond us in terms of evolution. The Martians, he said, were more moral, more peaceful, more technologically savvy than we are. And when the public came to believe this, it was almost like he had given them a new deity. People were looking to Mars to solve our problems on Earth. By 1908, there was an article I found published in a number of newspapers around the country when there was serious discussion of beginning communications with Mars, getting sending radio signals to Mars and hopefully getting a response. And this newspaper article had questions that the Martians might answer, okay? And you might think that we would ask them practical questions. You know, I mean, it was thought that they were more advanced than us, so we might ask them questions about technology. But no, the questions in this newspaper were these theological questions and philosophical questions. What is the meaning of life? Where does the soul go when you die? How can we prevent all human suffering? These were the questions that we wanted the Martians to answer. So the Martians had become, in essence, stand-ins for God. People really wanted to believe in them, and they did.
So do you think it was this projection that they wanted to impose our highest ideals upon an imaginary society?
Right. And, you know, again, it's not an exact parallel to today, but Elon Musk and his dreams of Mars, and he's not alone. There's quite an active group called the Mars Society, which is a private group of folks who are fans of colonizing Mars, who really are pushing the idea. And Elon Musk and the Mars Society talk about this utopian Mars, that Mars is a place where we can start over. We can build a better society. We can move beyond the obvious problems on Earth. And I think it's a wonderful dream. And I actually am very excited by the idea of getting people to Mars. I think Elon Musk's dreams of sending up a city of a million there in a few decades is wildly optimistic. But I think it does make sense to start sending people to Mars and seeing what we can do there. But are we really going to be able to leave the problems of Earth behind, or are we kidding ourselves? Are we projecting onto Mars what we hope is there rather than what
I got to hit this break, but I want to just mention this quickly. I mean, they say it'll be like a libertarian utopian society, but if everyone is living in these fragile environments, it's really going to be a hyper-fascist society, because you can't have any one individual deciding they're going to smash something and kill everyone else. So there'll be super surveillance, super monitoring, no tolerance for any deviation of behavior. it will not be a utopian. It will be a dystopian place to live. But anyway, we can talk more about that coming back. But let's get back to your book and about the Martians that people were so gaga about. And we'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company. They are committed to helping policyholders build strong and thriving businesses through their exceptional service. More at texasmutual.com/texansdeliver. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The Martians, the true story of an alien craze that captured turn-of-the-century America. The author is David Barron. He also wrote the best-selling book, American Eclipse, and he is a former NPR science correspondent. And you can call in with your questions and comments as we talk about this time when America was just this crazy about Mars. The number is 833-877-8255. 833-TPR-TALK, and let's go to a caller. Let's go to Claiborne. Claiborne, you're on the air.
Hey there. Two things. One, why would I want to go to Mars? We have the Big Ben and the RGV. And second, a persistent theme in sci-fi is the Mars colonies rebelling.
All right, Claiborne, thank you for that. Big Ben, I think maybe he's, being, jokey, but it's a seems like a regolith of a foreign planet out there at times. The environment's so harsh, but actually that would be paradise on Mars because it has breathable air. There is some plant life. It is not really – that would be great to have on Mars, wouldn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Mars is a dreadful place. I mean, we see these photographs beamed back by the NASA rovers, and it really does look sort of like Earth – like parts of Texas or Utah or Arizona. But my goodness, what a dreadful place. I mean, there's less than 1% of the atmospheric pressure there, so you'd need to wear a pressurized suit as well as, of course, breathe tanked oxygen. The radiation on the surface is very dangerous. The soil is toxic. The lack of gravity there means you'll probably end up having health problems living there over time. Just getting there is going to take 6 to 8 months, and that alone is a very dangerous trip. So we can't kid ourselves that getting to Mars or living there is going to be easy at all, let alone the idea of Mars colonies rebelling, of course.
Yeah, the rebelling, that's always, well, we'll see what happens. If they can have enough people there and that they would rebel, wow, that would, yeah, that means something. So, David, the idea that there was a discovery, a scientist, an Italian scientist, who saw that there were canals on Mars and how people misinterpreted his discovery. What happened there?
Right. So that's where the story begins, 1877 in Milan, Italy, with an astronomer named Giovanni Schiaparelli, who was a highly regarded astronomer, who that year, 1877, when Mars was making its closest approach to Earth in 15 years, he decided he was going to make a map of Mars. And so night after night, he studied the surface very carefully. But it's not a very easy thing to do. Looking at Mars 35 million miles away through Earth's atmosphere, which distorts the view, means it goes in and out of focus. It's kind of blurry. But you wait for moments when it becomes clear, and then you draw what you see. And what Schiaparelli saw were not only dark areas and light areas that were thought to be continents and oceans, but he saw these very fine lines scoring the surface, and he called them canali, which in Italian means channels. He thought they were some kind of water channels, but that was mistranslated into English as canals, suggesting that they were artificially built, and people knew that it was a mistranslation, and they sort of joked about it, but they didn't know what they were. But over time, it was this later astronomer I mentioned before, Percival Lowell, an American, who came up with a theory that they really were canals, not canals for shipping, but canals for irrigation. And so it's a complicated theory, and I'll boil it down, though. The idea was that Mars is a dying planet, he said. It was an older planet than Earth. It had once been lush, but it had lost most of its water. And all of the water that was left was tied up in the polar ice caps, which you can see from Earth. They grow and shrink through the seasons that the north and south pole of Mars. And so he thought, well, there's ice on Mars. When it melts in the spring, the Martians must tap that meltwater, bring it down through these canals to their cities and their farms. And he had this whole elaborate theory about it. But it seemed to explain these strange lines on Mars. And for a while, it was sort of seen as an interesting theory. But Lowell was extremely passionate, extremely articulate. He was a best-selling writer. He was super wealthy. He came from one of the wealthiest, most respected families in New England. He built his own astronomical observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona. It's still there, the Lowell Observatory. And he was such a good proponent of this idea that he really convinced the public that this was true, that the Martians were really there. And he had others, and I have many of them in my book, other important characters who came to believe this as well, including the inventor Nikola Tesla, who was a genius, who, after he transformed the way we generate and distribute electrical power with wires, he got interested in what was then called wireless, which today we call radio. He was a pioneer of radio. He, in 1899, thought he picked up radio signals from the Martians. And so when he told this to the world at the dawn of 1901, it just went nuts, and the Martians invaded popular culture. And that's, you know, Martians, of course, were part of science fiction through so much of the 20th century, but it all started during this era that I write about, when the Martians were thought to be real.
So the idea that canali, I would have translated that into cannolis, and so there would have been the cannolis of Mars. But the canalis were the canals. And I guess they figured, well, if there was this society working together in harmony in order to bring water to the rest of the planet so that so many people could survive, then therefore they must have a great society there. Is that it?
That is definitely part of it. So, right, the Martians, if they're to survive on this dying planet, they all must be rowing together to stay afloat, and to maybe to mix metaphors, they're bailing out the boat to stay afloat. And the most famous piece of fiction to come out of that era was H.G. Wells's The War of the Worlds, which was, of course, in 1938. Adapted for radio by Orson Welles, but it was written by H.G. Wells in 1897. And that's a story of the Martians coming to Earth to invade our planet and take it over. But remarkably, that was not the common view of the Martians. The common view was that they were peaceful, they were moral, and that if anything, they were our guardian angels. They were up there on the planet next door keeping an eye on us. And as soon as we could learn to communicate with them, they might actually be there to be our saviors.
And that is an interesting turn, because now Martians are typically depicted as a hostile force. I mean, the planet that they're on is named after the god of war. But, you know, even Marvin the Martian in those Bugs Bunny's cartoons, Bugs Bunny, he's always trying to destroy the planet Earth. Mars Attacks, you know, that Tim Burton film. There's a lot of, and all these other cheesy science fiction, Mars Needs Women, Santa Claus versus the Martians. A lot of Martians are bad guys. How did we get to that?
Well, but then at the same time, so I grew up in the 1960s, there was a sitcom called My Favorite Martian. Which
Bill Bixby, yeah, sure.
Right. But the Martian, who was played by Ray Walston, that was who played the Martian, he was a nice guy. So it was always both. But I think it was the 1938 War of the Worlds radio broadcast that brought back the idea of the evil Martians. Before that, and again, this was a real surprise to me when I was doing the historical research for my book, that back during the era when people widely believed that the Martians truly existed, people were generally not afraid of them. People really thought that the Martians would be our friends if we could get in touch with them.
I think it just follows along that projection idea that, you know, when America entered into a time when we were more paranoid and it became almost a Cold War kind of parable. You know, at the time, originally, the world was already stressed, going into World War I and after. There was a lot of hopefulness that there would be a way to have a peaceful world. Seems to be stronger, a stronger gravitational pull, and then later the paranoia took over.
Right, and this is getting beyond what I write about in my book, but
sorry,
I know
about
others.
That.
No, no, that's fine. But I'm just going to say, but others have written about the fact that, like, the I'm writing about the Mars craze at the turn of the last century, but then there was the UFO craze that was more the 1940s and 50s, and that others have said was really linked to the Cold War, and our fears of others coming to destroy us was just in the air.
So people. It was almost like a mass psychosis. Some people were convinced that they themselves were Martians.
Yeah, right. There were quite a few. So this was also an era when spiritualism was really big. People would go to seances. There was a great belief in thought transference. So at a number of seances, there were mediums who claimed that when they went into a trance, they would transport their souls to Mars and they would come back and report what they saw. I write about in my book, there was a gentleman in the early 1900s who wandered into a church in a fancy part of Manhattan one Sunday and got up to the pulpit and declared himself a messenger from Mars. And he started to declare, to bring the message from the people of Mars. So, there were definitely people who believed that they had a direct connection to Mars, a thought kind of connection to Mars, even if they weren't going there with their bodies.
And there was a crossover with the studies of the occult with Lowell. He studied like fire walking and other mysticism in the Far East. He traveled there and he would study that and write about
that. You are right about that. And in fact, a number of the other astronomers I write about, including Schiaparelli, the Italian who first reported the canali on Mars, the canals, he was involved in some experimental seances because there were serious questions about whether in seances people were getting in touch with the dead, if there were spirits around. And so there were scientists who were trying to study in a very scientific way what was happening at seances. And Schiaparelli held some experimental seances for that very reason.
So when you pitched this book that you wanted to write about the Martians, was that a tough sell?
Oh, gosh. This was a very, very long process. I don't know that it was a tough sell, but this was a very tough book to write. It took me over 7 years to do the research and writing. I mean, I collected thousands and thousands of newspaper articles about the Martians. I went to dozens of archives to look at the original papers of the people I write about, not just in the U.S., but also in Europe. I was having to decode handwritten diaries and letters. It took a lot of work. So just figuring out what the story was took several years to figure out who are the characters and what's the plot. But it all started with this question I had, having grown up in the 1960s with Marvin the Martian, with that sitcom, My Favorite Martian, just with Martians part of our culture. I was wondering, where did that come from? And when I started to look at old newspapers from this period, I just was astonished to open the New York Times in 1906 and read an article, a full-page article, in all seriousness, about the civilization on Mars. To read the Wall Street Journal in 1907, declaring at the end of the year that the biggest news of 1907 was proof of life, human life, on Mars, they said. Once I saw those articles, I was convinced there was a book here. But it took me several years to do enough research to put together a book proposal to get the contract to write the book. I love Martians. I think everyone loves Martians.
Yeah, I had some similar experiences. I had a Major Matt Mason action figure.
Oh, right. So did I, yes.
Yeah, you write about it in the book. And Edgar Rice Burroughs, you know, all over my bookshelf, reading about Mars and the moon and Earth's core, all these fantastical stories, it suddenly seemed like, why aren't we there already? Why, especially at the time of the NASA and the moon launch, what's holding us back? So when we come back from the break, we'll talk more about that. Our phone lines are open. What questions do you have about when Mars, they didn't attack, but they were certainly, latched onto our mind. Maybe there was a mind meld with the Martians at the time. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the Martians, the true story of an alien craze that captured turn-of-the-century America. David Barron is the author. He also wrote the bestseller American Eclipse, and he's also a former NPR science writer. So they have detected methane on the Mars, and some people say that that would be an indicator that there could be microbial life on Mars. There seems to be quite a stigma for anyone who does try to say that there is life on Mars in any kind of way. The Carl Sagan quote is like, if you have a massive claim, you should have massive evidence or something like that. You know, you should have the evidence to back it up, and that may not be enough. Do you think we've kind of swung the pendulum too far in saying, you know, we don't want to admit or even entertain the thought that there could be microbial life on Mars right now?
Well, actually, I would say that these days there's a lot of open-mindedness that there could be microbial life on Mars. But I would also say that the scientific community wants to make sure that the evidence is very strong before anyone declares that that's so. But the latest NASA rover, the Perseverance rover, has been up there for a few years now collecting rock samples in tubes, specifically with the idea that those may have evidence of at least past life, if not current life, on Mars. You know, the evidence today shows quite clearly that in its early years, several billion years ago, Mars was very lush and very Earth-like. And there's every reason to think that it was habitable, if not inhabited. And so if there was life that emerged on Mars several billion years ago, maybe we can find evidence of it. And it's even conceivable it could still be there underground. So I actually think in recent years, there's been a lot more openness among scientists to the idea that Mars could have life. But yes, I mean, for instance, in 1976, the Viking lander had several experiments to look for signs of life. And one of the experiments suggested that it may have found life. But most scientists say it's just the evidence wasn't strong enough that what it found may have been explained by chemistry, not biology.
So what happened to Mars's lush oceans, and where did it all go?
Well, that's a good question. Well, part of it was that Mars lost its magnetic field. I'm not exactly sure why that is.
I think it's because its core froze. It wasn't large enough to have the core that we have.
Yeah, I think that is leading theory, exactly. And so when it lost its magnetic field, that allowed the solar wind particles from the sun to strip away Mars's atmosphere over time. And in losing its atmosphere, Mars became much colder. Mars lost much of its water vapor, its carbon dioxide, and so forth. But some of Mars's old atmosphere is locked up now in the soil and in the ice caps. And so there are folks who say not only that maybe that we want to start inhabiting Mars and colonizing it, but maybe we should terraform Mars. We should turn Mars into a second Earth. And that, the idea is, if we could liberate some of that carbon dioxide and water that's now in the soil and the ice caps, you could create, in essence, a greenhouse effect on Mars, but a positive one, to heat up the planet and make it more Earth-like again.
Well, just yesterday, Elon Musk was wearing a T-shirt that said Nuke Mars when he was at Boca Chica at SpaceX. You're getting ready for that launch that didn't happen. So he wants to, you know, throw nuclear weapons at those polar caps and to, you know, get that water and create an atmosphere. So, yeah, he's one of those guys.
Right, exactly.
So not something that many people would, like, entertain. Well, who could stop him if he wanted to do that? Let's go to a caller. The number is 833-877-8255. Let's go to Randall. Hey, Randall, thanks for calling in. And Randall, you there?
Really interesting.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I am. Hello. Right.
Yes,
hello?
Sir. You're on now.
Can you hear me? Okay, great. So this ties into something because you were earlier talking about the old science fiction TV shows and the movies and things like that, and now you're talking about, you know, what happened to the Mars atmosphere, and that ties into the movie from 2000, Mission to Mars, with Gary Sinise, Connie Nielsen, Tim Robbins, and Don Cheadle, because towards the end of that movie, you know, there's this little, I don't know, they're standing in a space, and there's this kind of a diagram or something that's playing around them, and it shows how Mars was like Earth at one point, but then it got hit by a giant asteroid, and that laid waste to the environment and everything else. But really what I wanted to ask, Mr. Barron, was, is the science fiction getting any better, do you think? Because we look back at the old TV series and the movies from half a century ago, and you know, kind of like, no, it didn't exactly turn out like that. But Mission to Mars is a favorite movie of mine, and also The Martian from 2015 with Matt Damon and Jessica Chastain. It seems like they tried to emphasize the science more than the fiction on those, especially in how we travel to Mars. Do you feel like movies and TV, are we getting better at that, do you think?
All right, Randall, thank you for the question.
Yeah, Randall, I think you're absolutely right. That, and in fact, I know a lot of scientists really have praised the book, The Martian, and the movie, the book by Andy Weir, as being very true to the facts about Mars. But what I would say is the early science fiction was also based on the science of the time. The science wasn't right. but, you know, back at the turn of the last century, there were scientists saying that Mars was covered with canals. And that's what found its way into the fiction, because that was what people thought was really there. Today, we know there aren't canals on Mars. So I think the fiction has really followed the science over the decades.
Thomas Edison, 1910, made a film. I don't know if he made it, but it's under his studio, you know, Trip to Mars, where they, you know, battle creatures and things. So it's basically the same plot as a lot of these same movies that come out today.
Right. I mean, but it's again, the fiction has always been, piggybacking on the science, but interestingly, the fiction then also spurs on the science. And this is one of the things I write about toward the end of my book. You know, there was, even though what I write about this Mars craze back at the turn of the beginning of the 20th century seems very frivolous and whimsical, and it is in some ways, it had some real and very positive effects, because the excitement about Mars back then really spawned modern science fiction. In fact, you've probably heard of the Hugo Awards, these big awards in science fiction. They're named after a man named Hugo Gernsback, who is considered the father of modern science fiction. Hugo Gernsback committed his life to science fiction because as a kid, he was totally infatuated by the Mars that Percival Lowell wrote about. And Edgar Rice Burroughs, we talked about, he wrote a whole series of books about Mars that were super bestsellers at the time. Well, the science fiction about Mars then turned around and inspired the scientists. So Robert Goddard, who is the man who built the first liquid-fueled rocket, he's considered the father of American rocketry. He decided to devote his life to rocketry because as a kid, he read H.G. Wells's The War of the Worlds and thought, geez, I wonder if it is possible to go between Mars and the Earth, and how would we do that? And he invented the rocket. Wernher von Braun, the rocket scientist from Germany who built rockets for the Nazis before he came to the U.S. and built them for NASA after World War II, he too was inspired as a kid reading science fiction about Mars that in Germany, but it was all based on Percival Lowell's view of a canal-covered Mars. So there's this interesting interplay between the science and the fiction.
Well, I think the fiction creates that itch that we have, you know, in society. When we experience these things, you know, vicariously through reading and watching films, and And we really want that to happen, whether it be to come up with communicators like on Star Trek, you know, and that's why we were all crazy about flip phones for a while, you know, because there was like very Star Trek-y. You know, we just, and it's like, let's make this happen. Let's make it real. And so I do see the connection, you know, between what happened at the turn of the century with this craze and the drive now to, you know, as a nation, we're spending billions, if not more, to try to make that a reality.
Right. And, you know, I actually see that my book has two kind of contradictory lessons to it. On the one hand, it's a cautionary tale about how easy it is for we humans to fool ourselves into believing things to be true because we so want them to be true. People wanted to believe in the Martians. Percival Lowell, who was promoting the idea, so wanted to believe in the Martians that he blinded himself to the evidence suggesting that his theory was wrong. At the same time, imagination is very important in science and in driving exploration. There's nothing wrong with imagination as long as it's harnessed to reality. And I think certainly in the early years when Percival Lowell was pushing his theory, it was a perfectly legitimate and interesting theory to explain these so far unexplained lines on Mars. Maybe Mars was inhabited. Maybe these were irrigation canals. And when Percival Lowell died in 1916, by then his theory had pretty well been disproven. And he, I would say, had become kind of delusional. He could not accept the downfall of his theory. But when he died, the obituaries were incredibly forgiving. They did not ridicule this man who had sent society down this dead end, believing about this Martian civilization that never existed. The obituaries were really laudatory. They were talking about how he inspired people to think beyond our small Earth. To get excited about astronomy. And it really that he really did do that. It was the children who grew up in that era who helped to launch the space age through the 20th century.
Taking another break. Our phone lines are open. If you get a question, a comment, you want to tell us about your obsession with Mars, I would love to hear it. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. When do you think we're going to land on Mars? When will people set foot on Mars? And why do we need people to set foot on Mars? I'd love to hear your response to that. 833-877-8255. The Source continues right after this quick one-minute break. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. David Barron is with us. He wrote that book, American Eclipse, and now he has a new book, The Martians, The True Story of an Alien Craze That Captured Turn-of-the-Century America. So, David, when do you think we will have people on Mars?
I expect before the end of the 2030s. Now, I acknowledge that people have been predicting for decades now that there will be humans on Mars in 15 years, and it keeps getting pushed off. When Elon Musk and Donald Trump were getting along not that long ago, it really looked like things might get jump-started. I mean, now I'm not quite sure in terms of the U.S., but if we don't get there, the Chinese will. You know, the Chinese are dead set on sending astronauts to Mars, to the moon, and then on to Mars. And I think that's probably the main thing that's going to keep us in the game is national pride. I think we're going to see a competition between the U.S. and China the way we did between the U.S. and the USSR back in the 1960s.
During this craze for Mars during that turn of the century, did it actually drive any scientific discoveries in terms of, like, did telescopes get better? Were people really interested in studying, other planets and things?
Well, interestingly, so Percival Lowell, who was the main proponent of the idea of a canal-covered Mars, he did some really good things. I mean, he established the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, which is still there, which has done good work. One of the things that he did to try to prove that the canals were there was he helped to develop some better techniques of photography, of astrophotography. So taking pictures of other planets was very difficult, you can imagine, with the technology of the time. But he was so dead set on proving that those canals were there that he and his assistants developed photographic techniques to actually take photographs of the surface of Mars. Now, they were extremely small. These photographs were a quarter inch across and very grainy. But for the time, they were considered a real revelation. Lowell said they proved that the canals were there, but still, it was a matter of interpretation. But he really helped push forward the development of the ability to photograph other planets.
And he sent a observatory to Chile, like a massive multi-ton observatory. They took one apart. They sent it down. They carried it across Panama because there was no canal at the time, and they brought it down to Chile. That seems like that he had focus and drive and resources.
Oh, gosh, yeah. So that I see as kind of the crazy climax of the book. So Lowell, again, he was a man with almost unlimited resources and a huge ego, and he was dead set on proving to the world that his Mars theory was correct. And so he had developed this photographic technique, and he was taking photographs of Mars from Flagstaff in 1903 and 1905. Mars comes around close to Earth every 2 years, so you have a chance every couple of years to take these photographs. But in 1907, Mars was again going to come close to Earth, but even closer, but it would be better seen from the southern hemisphere than the northern hemisphere. So Percival Lowell, with his great wealth, hired another astronomer who was a friend and acolyte of his named David Todd, who headed the astronomy department at Amherst College in Massachusetts. And he had David Todd disassemble the university's 7-ton telescope, load it into 116 boxes, take them on a train down to New York, put them on a ship down to Panama, take it over the isthmus because the canal wasn't finished yet, put on another ship down to Chile on a train up into the Atacama Desert, and then had this 7-ton telescope reassembled so that he could take over 10,000 tiny photographs of Mars when Mars made its close approach. And that was what was considered the proof, just the absolute proof that Lowell was right. These photographs were said to show the canals without any doubt. And that's when the Wall Street Journal said, okay, it's done. We have proof that there are people on Mars. And by 1908, it seemed that Lowell had won the day. And it was all through this crazy expedition to carry that enormous telescope to the middle of nowhere in Chile.
The idea that, you know, scientists would allow their imaginations to get in the way of their observations. Different people saw different things. That should have been a clue that this is not, a fact, right?
Well, we all do it. It is, scientists, when they design proper experiments, design them with the knowledge that they can't trust themselves, right? We all have our own ideas, and we are all prone to see the evidence in favor of our ideas and to dismiss the evidence against them. It's called confirmation bias. It's been known for centuries. And Lowell did not do a good job of protecting himself from his own biases. I think we still see the same thing today. You know, there's an astronomer at Harvard named Avi Loeb who wrote a best-selling book a few years ago called Extraterrestrial, where he was claiming that this object called Oumuamua, that was an interstellar object that came through our solar system a number of years ago, he contended was actually an alien spaceship. And
we got another one now. I mean, this is the 3I Atlas.
Exactly. Now there's another one of these interstellar objects coming through the solar system, and he's making a similar claim. And I think that, I don't mean to besmirch the guy. I don't know him personally, but I know a lot of astronomers see him almost like a modern day Percival Lowell, that someone who's highly educated, very smart, but who seems so dead set on this pet theory of his that he dismisses the evidence against what he believes and just rallies all the evidence in favor of it.
Well, this 3i Atlas, it's supposed to be a interstellar comet, the third mm-hmm. one ever discovered. And they, some people are, because it seems to be generating its own light. That's what they're going on about. And that it is, they say it's an alien probe or a spacecraft or some sort of technological artifact from a different solar system. They're going on about its trajectory and how it could be a craft that is driven by a light engine. And there's a lot of clickbait articles or videos on YouTube about it. And I confess it's like a guilty pleasure to watch these things because it's fun. You know, I don't know if it's real or not. It doesn't matter really, but it seems fun to kind of think about it.
Yeah. And as I said, you know, I think a lot of good came out of the Mars craze of 100 years ago and Percival Lowell's imagination. And who knows, maybe Oumuamua and this latest supposed comet really are extraterrestrial spacecraft. And we should look into it. And why not imagine that it's true? But let's remember that that's, you know, that is for many people, and I would say for me too, an appealing idea. I would be thrilled if it turned out it was proof that there's a civilization out there. I would be very excited. But the fact that it's something I would want to believe is true is a reason to be extra skeptical of myself. So why not? Let's imagine that it might be true, but let's not go overboard and say that it's by any means proven or even the most likely.
But it does help me step into the shoes of the people who, in your book, who were captured by that story, the alien craze. You know, it's fun, it's interesting, it's exciting, it's, you know, hey, this thing, 3i Atlas, wow, what is that? These canals, what is that? That's interesting. You know, I am not turning up my nose at them and thinking about what a bunch of schmucks, you know. It seems like, wow, I don't blame them.
I agree. I mean, I think it's fun to dream of what's out there, and I can assure you what's actually in outer space, it must be so far beyond anything we can imagine. When we finally start, you know, getting our telescopes that can look at the surface of planets outside our solar system, or if we can send probes to other solar systems, I mean, I'm talking, you know, a million years from now, or certainly thousands of years from now, for some of that stuff, I'm sure that the universe has so many mysteries yet to be solved.
But this is, your story seems to be a story that has been largely forgotten, that this happened, that this craze was real. And so why do you think that it was, we erased it from our collective memory?
Well, I don't know if it was erased. It just morphed into something else. Again, I think, you know, Mars and Martians still have a real hold on our collective psyche. Mars, there's just this sense that it's different from the other planets. I think that, we all seem to forget what happened last year or last month. We're also focused on what's happening today. Something that happened 120 years ago seems like it's completely irrelevant. But it did change our culture, and those cultural effects continue to ripple down.
And do you think that's why we still, you know, have that itch to go to Mars, that we're willing to, you know, support that as, you know, it's a national policy to get to Mars? And do we have people like Elon Musk who's spending his vast fortune blowing up rockets? Each one, each time it's another multi-million dollars, you know, let's get to Mars. That's the drive.
I think it's part of it. I mean, part of it is it's the easiest place to go. It's the planet next door that you actually could land on. You're not going to land on Venus. But, you know, Elon Musk, why did he decide to go into the rocket business? Because he read A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy when he was a kid by Douglas Adams. He himself had read science fiction by another author who was inspired by H.G. Wells, who wrote The War of the Worlds back then. So, I mean, you don't have to, you can easily connect the dots of the science and the science fiction from the turn of the last century and how it was handed down generation to generation.
Incredible dots. In the book, The Martians, The True Story of an Alien Craze That Captured Turn of the Century America. David Barron, thanks for coming on The Source.
Thank you.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.